This is a podcast from JUF.org.
Journalist Amanda Forsyth was born in South Africa, raised in Canada, and has been continuing to traverse the globe ever since, bringing her music with her. Her partner in these travels is her cello, which has logged even more miles since it had a head start, having been built in 1699. She'll be in Chicago on the weekend of May 20th to 21st with the Zuckerman Trio for a Zuckerman Weekend at the Music Institute of Chicago. Hello, Amanda. We're calling you New York?
Yes.
What are you up to there? Is that where you
live? I'm right now at the Cloisters in New York, which is a beautiful day, and I've never been here before.
Oh.
So I took the subway up to a very high numbered street. And then here I am, and it's beautiful, sunny. All the flowers are out, and the birds are out. And maybe you can hear the birds in the background, maybe.
I can. What key are they in?
It's cacophony. Cacophony.
I see. Tell us about this weekend in Chicago. What can we expect?
Beethoven Trio in B-flat, and Shostakovich Piano Trio number 2, and Dvorak Dymphy Trio. Good, now I know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
So it's at the Nicholas Concert Hall. Mm-hmm. In Evanston, correct. Right. This will be probably our third time playing there. So I think the other two times we played there, we joined some of the Chicago Symphony musicians to play sextets and quintets. And so this time it's just the Zuckerman Trio.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about the trio, who's in it, how it got started?
Mm-hmm. We started as the Zuckerman Chamber Players, which is a string quintet, two viola quintet. And we started it in Ottawa when I was principal cello of the National Arts Center Orchestra, and Pekus was the music director. Mm-hmm. And the other players were ex-students of his from New York, who happened to be also now in the National Arts Center Orchestra. And then the fifth player was a violist from England who works in Barcelona, principal viola of the Barcelona Symphony. And so we formed this group because we wanted to play with the, you know, the young... real talent. Well, Pincus has a thing for talent, obviously.
Yes.
And so his ex-students, now colleagues of ours, was very exciting. And so we were the quintet for about quite a few years, maybe 6 or 7 years.
Wow.
And we toured a lot in Germany. We went to Schleswig-Holstein festivals and Aspen, and let's see, did we go to Asia together? We went to Australia, we went to New Zealand, so we played a lot together. Then then we decided to switch from the two viola quintet to a piano quintet, and so that we could have a varied program. So each program would have a duo, a trio, and a piano quartet, and a quintet.
Wow.
So we used our players, and it was really, so we toured a lot with that. And then when we left Ottawa, the orchestra, realized it would be difficult to have as much touring time because the other two players were in the orchestra.
Right.
So we changed to the trio. So then we had already been playing with Angela Cheng, C-H-E-N-G, as the quintet, and then we just sort of whittled it down to the trio. And I just love it. It's more soloistic playing.
Uh-huh.
Because it's, you know, only two string players on the piano.
Right.
So, and we've been together now, including the quintet time, about 10 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
Angela always remembers the date, but I don't remember the date.
Is there a certain kind of music you focus on? Certain composers, certain era, certain modes?
Mostly strictly known composers.
Mm-hmm.
We have played a trio by my father, Malcolm Forsyth, who's passed away 6 years ago. He's a wonderful Canadian composer.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And we are going to have some things written for us, but I'm not allowed to say by who yet, because other composers will get upset.
Sure.
So for example, this program we're playing is a tiny trio by Beethoven, which is just a one movement, so it's almost like a overture.
Okay.
And then the Dvorak Dymphy Trio is a great piece for cello. It's got all the folk tunes in it. And it's very, very thought-provoking. It's not classical,
mm-hmm.
per se. It's not romantic, per se. It's that particular trio is very odd. It has about seven movements, and you can't really tell which is which. They go into each other. But it's really got some Gypsy in there, and then the Shostakovich trio we're playing is a huge work. Very difficult musically, historically speaking, and also instrumentally speaking. And it's very, very, it's very deep piece. I mean, a deep piece with all the, you know, thoughts of Stalin and such. But the actual piece itself is so, can't find the word. It's such a mammoth work that it just takes over your whole being when you're performing it.
Wow.
It's, it's amazing work. Not a happy work, but absolutely gorgeous.
So there's a lot of thinking you have to do while you're playing it. It isn't, you can't just go on autopilot.
Yeah, it's almost programmatic because it starts with this incredible solo on the cello of false harmonics, which is very bleak. And the other two players are not playing for a few minutes.
Wow.
And it just kind of starts very softly, and it comes from nowhere. and it's been talked about a lot why Shostakovich wrote that. In fact, the first time it was premiered, Shostakovich was in the audience to hear the rehearsal of the players, and the pianist was Vladimir Ashkenazi, and it was in Russia.
Wow.
And there were some queries about tempo markings and things. So they played the trio thinking you'd sort of coach them on it, and they wanted to know what the tempo actually was of one of the movements. And then he basically stood up and said, thank you, and left. So they were like, oh, well, that wasn't very helpful. So actually, Ashkenazi told me that story recently, which is a wonderful way to hear about things. It's
right.
Like having folk stories passed on
exactly.
through the generations, isn't it?
Well, I think what sometimes happens is people forget about the personalities involved of the composers.
Of the who?
The personalities of the composers.
Yeah.
You know, they were real people. I mean, it's, you know, you think of them as these sort of iconic historic figures, but we forget that they had lives and personalities and conflicts and then friendships and sometimes, you know, they played off of each other.
And he had the outlet, you know, to get back at Stalin somehow with the outlet of his music. I mean, so when you hear something that sounds like a wonderful, happy march. It's actually a stab at Stalin, so to speak.
Wow.
He's put the march in because Stalin wanted that.
Right.
But at the same time, he was writing it saying, you know, fine, I'll put this march in here for you so that my music isn't blacklisted.
Right. Sort of a sarcastic.
Yeah.
Bring it in there. It's interesting. You started playing cello when you were 3 years old?
We just immigrated from South Africa to Canada, and they had just started the Suzuki program for cello. So they're actually violas upside down with an M pin in it. This is the Suzuki way, is that every child is playing together, and we're learning our twisted variations, but they're all upside down violas.
Because I was going to say, why would you find a cello small enough for a 3-year old?
Yeah. They make 16th size, and then they make what's after 16th size. I remember the 16th size, 8th size, the quarter size, then there's a half size, a three-quarter size, 7/8, and full size.
I came into someone's house one time, and I said, you know, who plays the viola da gamba? And they're like, no, that's our child's practice cello.
Oh, the practice cello, yeah. I have one of those, too.
Right,
Yamaha.
It's a very small child. What was the draw of the cello for you, even at that age? Or did they just say, they just hand it to you and said, this is yours now?
Well, I was 2 and a half, they put it in my hands, and that was that. I mean, I don't think I had much choice in the matter. It was like, here's your doll, and here's your cello.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's just part of me, I guess.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to have it, the cello that you have now that's so old?
Carlo came to me because my cello that I'd had, my first full-size cello, which was made for me in 1981, was stolen, actually, from my locker at the National Arts Center in
God.
Ottawa. And at that point, I had to, because I was playing more solo, and Pink had said, you know, it's probably time that you get a really fine Italian instruments. And I've been shown instruments over the years. Oh, take this to Amanda because I'm a very strong player. Mm-hmm. And so certain instruments will suit you better.
Right.
And so I just thought people were trying to make a buck and show me a cello all the time. So I just basically ignored everyone and carried on with my modern cello. But then when I had the theft, and I had to play all sorts of different other cellos to try to find out what I like.
Uh-huh.
I remembered this cello, this Carlo Giuseppe Tostori, which was brought to me a few years back. And after trying all these other wonderful cellos, I thought, wait a minute, where's that other cello that
right.
I was pretending not to be interested in? And strangely enough, he waited for me, and then no one had even looked at the cello. So
really?
He became mine, and it was his next.
So Carlo is the name of the cello or the name of the person who created it? Or
the maker is Carlo Giuseppe Testore.
Okay.
So I just call him Carlo.
Just call it. You know what? If you're with an object, you know, all day, every day, you give it a name.
If I'm with a what? I can't hear you.
If you're with an object, whether it's a car or a computer or something, all day, every day, you sometimes,
yeah.
you know, need to call it something. I mentioned earlier that you've gone all around the world. Tell us about how much you love Chicago.
Mm.
Not self-serving at all.
I'm not gonna say it's windy. well, I love Chicago because it's not at all like New York, is it? And at the time when I started to come there to play, it was U.S. in general. I went to school at Juilliard in New York, but I'd lived in Canada for all those years, so
right.
it was very, very exciting. Magnificent Mile. it's just completely, I can't put my finger on it, but my goodness, Joan Harris's hall that she's built there and that the Harris Theater on the water, over there, it's not on the water, is it? Next to those, what are those signs that where the faces change? You know, those
right,
computer,
right. The
is that by the Roosevelt University?
Sort of. It's the Crown Fountains, they're called. The
right. Oh, that's right. And then her hall is there?
It's near there. It's a Millennium Park.
Yeah.
It's at that area.
It's amazing. Okay. We were actually at the opening there.
Oh, wow.
When the seats had just been put in.
Hmm.
And she's a fantastic woman, and her apartment's right on the lake. And I don't know, I have a very big affection for older ladies who've had wonderful lives, you can tell me all about it. But that's my Chicago story.
Okay.
It's amazing. You can just walk into this bridge and you're on the beach.
Right, right. We do. People forget that Chicago is a beach. It's not sunny here all the time.
But
when it is, it's very sunny.
I spent a few days in Chicago. The last time I was there, actually. What? No, I've been there since. But when my father passed away, I was in Brazil, about to play a few concerts there, and I spoke to him on the phone, and he seemed to think he was at home, but he wasn't. He was in the hospital, so I just suddenly left, and I flew. I was going back to Edmonton to see him, and when I landed in Chicago, he'd already passed away.
Oh,
so I was stuck. So we just stayed in Chicago for about 5 days, and I was in a haze, obviously. But
sure.
I spent a lot of time in the art galleries, just staring at beautiful paintings and trying to sort it all out. So that's a real big memory for me that I just remembered.
Oh, thank you for sharing that.
It was a therapeutic few days, put it that way.
When you do travel, though, I mean, how much of the cities that you go to perform in do you actually get to see, or is it all in practice rooms
exactly.
and concert halls?
Exactly. Especially if you're on tour. Play concerts, go out afterwards, get up early in the morning, and then go to the next city.
Wow.
So I did make a conscious effort to take photos of the front of the concert hall for change, because I never do that. I thought, wait, what did the front look like? So, like, we're in Vienna, and I'm at the Musikverein. Obviously, I'm going to go to the front of the hall and see what it looks like, which is the most beautiful place.
Oh,
but
sure.
I've been doing that, sort of cataloging
funny.
All the concert halls we play at.
Well, you're sort of going in the back entrance off the alley. You don't get to see the...
Exactly, by the rubbish.
Right. Oh, dear. So what about when you played with the Israel Philharmonic? When you were at the Israeli Philharmonic, did you get to see any of Israel?
Oh, my gosh. It's my favorite place in the world. Absolutely. I mean, I went to the Dead Sea. I mean, I've been there so many times now that I usually stay there for quite a few days, and I'm the one who wants to be there. And my Israeli husband didn't really want to be there, but I sort of brought him back to it. Now because I'm so I love it so much that he's happy to be there now because, you know, we're there together.
That's wonderful.
But that's an amazing country, and the people are so open.
Yeah.
It's so refreshing for a Canadian. Rude.
Are you, so you've been there
terrible.
A lot.
Very, in your face, which is kind of good. Especially when you're a musician. You should be in people's faces when you're a musician. You're a performer, right?
Right. Okay.
And it's beautiful, and the people are beautiful, and the air is amazing.
Oh.
Have you been to the Dead Sea?
I have. Just this last
Isn't
year.
Isn't that amazing?
It is. Oh. It is.
I know. I don't think I've experienced anything like that.
We had our hotel right on the Dead Sea, and
I loved it.
I loved it. My wife loved it. Our small child did not.
And what?
We have a 7-year-old. You know, he's used to the beach in Chicago, and this water was very different.
Right.
He was quite prepared for it. But he'll, when he gets older, we'll try again. Are you part of other ensembles as well, or mostly solo performer?
No, I'm not anymore. No, I'm just solo and the trio.
Okay.
But of course, I mean, I'm a guest artist. One of the guest artists, I'll play with other musicians. So I just was in Savannah at the Savannah Music Festival, which has all types of music. You know, they have jazz and blues and rock and R&B and classical, all in this amazing festival. And so we played with the ex-violinist of the Beaux-Arts Trio, Daniel Hope, and a couple of colleagues of mine from Juilliard days. That was really nice.
That's great. Personally, what are some of your favorite pieces to play, your favorite composers? I mean, I know what you play with the trio, but if you had to choose.
With the trio?
No, just in general.
Well, I love the Bimki. You mean of our repertoire?
Yeah, of the repertoire, just in general. Which pieces do you like to... do you like to perform? Are there any specific composers you prefer, or?
No, I mean, there's so many. Mm-hmm. I could never choose my favorite composer.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
that's
it's usually what I'm playing at the moment.
Okay.
I have a big love affair with Don Quixote by Strauss, which I just performed in Vancouver.
Oh.
I love that concerto because it has a story, and it's something about being on your podium with your cello, imagining that you actually are charging the windmills.
Right.
But I make up stories with any piece I play. So it's just that Strauss wrote this based on a Cervantes novel, but it's nice to have that story. It's an amazing piece, too. I love Richard Strauss, I have to say.
I found out that I was born on Cervantes' birthday, so I have a special affinity for Don Quixote specifically.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Also, John Lennon's birthday, so I don't know what to make of that.
That's rather eclectic mix.
Yeah, it is. What do you think can be done to help...
Sorry, I can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me start over. What do you think can be done to increase the public awareness and fondness for classical music? I think a lot of people feel it's intimidating. How do we get more people to listen to the classical repertoire?
I think it starts in the schools. They need to keep music in the schools because, I mean, they're cutting music out of the schools, and that's the most complete art form, and it's so important for children to have that. Some sort of musical awareness or training or, you know, experience. But that's the real big problem in education.
Okay.
It's an ongoing problem. Why is the audience so old? We have to build a new generation of audiences, and that has a lot to do with education.
I agree. So what else?
When an orchestra has a kids series, this is important. You know, Chicago does that, of course.
Yes.
It's really important that the musicians from the orchestras go to schools in small groups, and I know we did that a lot at the National Arts Center Orchestra, and also I was in the Calgary Philharmonic, and we go out, you know, what do they call it, outreach.
Right.
I mean, we went up to the Northern Territories in Canada and taught the First Nations people mm-hmm. and learned about their music as well. Oh. I mean, they wouldn't have the chance to come into a big city like sure. Toronto, you know. That's a different kind of outreach. But
I think music is an excellent tool for that. It can reach across borders and boundaries.
Yes. And heal you. Mm-hmm. And therapy. Dogs and music, I think that's a good combination.
Hmm. Okay.
Therapy. You need dogs and you need music.
Right.
That just stopped. That just
there
made
you
it
go. Away. There you go. What else do you have lined up for this year?
Oh, gosh. What don't I have lined up for this year? I'm leaving tomorrow for Italy. I have a tour with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. And then I think we're going to go to the world's best restaurant in Modena because someone just told me about it. It was voted the best restaurant in the world. What does that mean?
Okay.
So I will have a day off to do that. So that's good. And mm-hmm. then I go on to London and play at the Royal Festival Hall with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. And then go to Korea for some concertos there. Can't remember what orchestra that is. And what else is happening? Go back to Australia. I'm there almost every 2 years, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And then, it's just like an ongoing treadmill.
Wow. If you ever decide to have another career, you could write travel books.
Right. I would just train dogs.
Train dogs. Do you have dogs?
I have had dogs, but I don't have one presently because of too much traveling.
Yes.
Yeah. It's sad. I borrow everyone else's dogs.
Oh, okay. That's probably better. You don't have to do all the, all the bathing and walking and.
Right.
You know.
In fact, when I was at Juilliard, before I knew there was a business for dog walkers, I would kind of just offer myself in Riverside Park and end up with lots of people's house keys. And this is the 80s. I mean, I could have stolen all their stuff and their dogs, but I just wanted to be with the dogs, so I ended up with, like, 3 dogs one weekend, and I had all these keys, and I'm sorry, but I didn't get paid for it.
Well, you got the therapy from it.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, therapy dog therapy. All right, well, we're looking forward to seeing you in person here in Chicago in May, and thank you very much.
Too.
Okay, take care.
Wonderful.
Bye.
See you soon.
This has been a podcast from the Jewish United Fund, Jewish Federation of Metropolitan Chicago. For more information, visit juf.org.